Good morning. About 25 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist, a member of the board at Creation Moments, and a resident of Garden Valley, Texas. And I'm wondering, Don, you're off to our north and our east a bit. There was a lot of severe weather last night in central Texas. Did you get some of that?
Oh, we got a lot of it.
Yeah.
We had thunderstorms. We had a lot of wind, and we finally got a lot of rain. And so our pond is almost filled up now.
Uh-huh.
We were a little concerned because we hadn't had a lot of rain this winter, but now it's almost full, which is good for the grapevines, obviously.
So we didn't see tornadoes. There were some tornadoes in that system, but you didn't get one of those, thankfully.
We didn't, but there were times when I thought, wow, that is a lot of wind. I was wondering whether or not we were in the midst of one, but I don't see any damage to the trees or anything else.
Envisioned grapes flying through the air in a circular motion and leaves fluttering around, and there goes the vintage. Not this year.
Well, the vines are still dormant, thankfully.
All right.
So we didn't have any of that, but it was quite windy and quite stormy, and we hadn't had one of these in quite some time. So it was good to get the rain, but maybe not so hard as it did.
Just to complete the weather picture, David was supposed to get some snow up north there in East Dakota. Did you get snow?
Just a dusting.
Nothing too severe there either.
A little bit. We're supposed to get some more today.
Okay. Well, congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah.
I'm sure you're looking forward to it.
Most of the snow has melted, and there's a lot of green grass or a lot of brownish green grass, and poking through the grounds, but. Yeah, it's got a little dusting of a white, looks like a confectioner's sugar.
Okay.
But we're supposed to get some more today, and up to an inch.
Well,
that won't last.
That's terrific news, then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good news. Good news all around.
I wonder what Isaac Newton would have thought of all these weather. Now, he wasn't a weather guy. It's not like he grew up to be a meteorologist. Don, we're looking at a biography of Sir Isaac Newton today, and with the purpose of really trying to dig into what a scientist is and what he does and what he did traditionally compared to now. Are scientists the same as they were? Do they all start, as did Sir Isaac Newton, as an autistic, brilliant young child whose potential was recognized early on? Is that not a valid assumption? Is there something different about scientists?
Well, you know, there's different people, different scientists. I think one of the main characteristics of the scientist of old and Newton, Kepler, Galileo, Galilei, for example, they had one thing in common, and that was a belief in God, and that God created the universe and everything in it. And so it was a natural thing to assume that the physical universe that they were looking at had some order to it, and that you could actually describe that order.
Okay, well, what brought them to a fascination with God then? Was it did the mathematics? Because to me, mathematics is absolute proof of God's existence. And I was pretty good at math all the way up to the college level when I bumped up against my ceiling and I couldn't go any farther in it. But it taught me a lot, and I'm wondering if the early scientists, if that's how they, or was it the culture? Because they were in devoutly Christian societies with devoutly Christian families. What was the motivation for their belief in God, do you suppose?
Oh, I think it was, they were raised in it, for sure. And so their heritage had a lot to do with it. I don't think it was necessarily any aspect of science, whether it was math or chemistry or physics or whatever it was that they were specializing
in. So then mathematics would have become the evidence for God.
Would be part of the evidence, because mathematics, I mean, it's used to describe the physical world around us. And even Newton himself, for example, he was dabbling in mathematics and liked mathematics, and he got very close to discovering calculus. I mean, he was almost there when he, with his binomial theories that he proposed and was working out, and it was just a short time later that everyone said, well, okay, if you keep dividing things up, then you'll get to infinity, and that's what makes calculus, is mm-hmm. that you've divided things up so small that it becomes almost
he was building on somebody else's work, was he not? John Wallis was a scientist who Newton admired and studied and drew from, and he's the guy, I had to do a little research on this, and John Wallis was the English scientist who adopted the symbol for infinity, which is also called a lazy eight, which is kind of interesting, and it's also called it's a lemniscate, you know, that this figure eight lying on its side, it's an endless loop. But Newton picked up his work and improved upon it. He also picked up work from Kepler, who was into astronomy and telescopes. I didn't realize that Newton invented a reflecting telescope. That's a surprise to me. He was a jack of all trades.
He was indeed. And not only, I mean, because the reflecting telescope came out of his interest. Now, this is, this is a true scientist is interested in a lot of things. You know, so they don't necessarily just focus on one thing. Now, a lot of scientists today focus on one thing because things are so complex that in order to make any headway in a particular field, you got to really focus on that field in order, to figure out things that other people haven't figured out before. But in the early days, the scientists were more generalist, and so he had an interest in optics, and it was out of the interest of in optics, in reflection in particular, that he came up with the mathematics in order to design, for example, the reflecting telescope, which is named after mm-hmm. him. So you can actually go on Amazon and look up a Newtonian telescope, and that design was Newton's original design. Of course, they may have modified it and mm-hmm. added bells and whistles to it, but it's basically the same type of telescope that Newton himself not only discovered but made, and was part of his work that got him into the Royal Society.
And you could have it delivered tomorrow.
You could have it delivered tomorrow. Now there's all kinds of reflecting telescopes now, but it's all based on Newton's original work. So he was interested in optics. I mean, obviously he was interested in body movement, and studied Kepler and came up with the three laws of motion, out of Kepler's work, and also came up with gravity. Of course, everybody kind of thinks of Newton as throwing the apple off the Tower of Pisa, and
is that the whole story? I thought he was sitting under an apple tree.
It was an apple tree, and the apple fell, and it hit him on the head, and he said, voila, gravity. And the fairy tale.
He wouldn't have said voila.
I mean, he did the foundational work on gravity mm-hmm. and how massive objects attract each other, and of course, Einstein put the apple on the cake, if you will, by his work on special relativity and general relativity, and realized that, hey, space itself is warped around heavy objects. But if you're going back to the characteristic of a scientist, I mean, he's got to be curious, or she has to be curious about the things around us. And what more curiosity could you have than to try to figure out how God put this world together? And that's been kind of my interest in a lot of things. You know, you want to know how things work, how things work in the natural. So, you know, how a cell is put together and how plants grow and different types of things like that. The planets in, you know, how do they revolve around themselves and what makes them have the orbits that they have. And, you know, things of that nature. So it's, I think, the fundamental characteristic of a scientist, of a true scientist, is to be curious. Now, you've obviously have to be able to understand, and so mathematics is a big help, although Einstein was one of those fellows who he had the idea as to what special relativity and general relativity is all about, or it possibly could be about, but he didn't have the mathematical background to describe it in a mathematical way. So he had to have help from a mathematician to describe curved spaces, for example, which then led to the general relativity of gravity. I mean, of his general theory of relativity. So you don't necessarily have to be an expert in any particular one field, but you do have to have this curiosity that drives you to
Is a scientist out to answer the question how or answer the question why?
He can't answer the question why. That's in Newton here, even says that. He said, you know, look at the world, basically look at the world around you, and there is all kinds of evidence for God in the way things are designed. And matter of fact, I was going to close with this, but since you got there a little earlier, Newton himself is quoted as saying, this is the last couple of sentences of this particular article, gravity explains the motions of the planets, but it cannot explain who set the planets in motion. God governs all things and knows all things that is or can be done. So he was very much, belief in God, in that while we can describe the world around us, we can't know why things are there. That is left to the realm of understanding.
And I think if the question of why so absorbs you, you become either a philosopher or a podcaster, one of the two.
Or both. I don't know. Maybe a philosophical podcaster. I think how, from a science point of view, the question is how. How do things work? Why do, why do the planets revolve? Why is the universe the way it is? Why is the sun, how does the sun work? What's fueling the sun, for example? And out of that, you come up with answers. But you can't know. Why is the sun there? Well, it's to give light, light on the earth. But you get that information from actually the Bible. In the first chapter of the Bible, in Genesis 1, the reason as to why the sun is there and the moon, it's to give the greater light, for example, which is the sun, to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. And so we have the why from the Bible, and God didn't leave us alone to, question everything, especially things that we couldn't get our hands on, if you will. But he reinforces it through, what the Bible has to say about the world around us and of course, how we should live together, one with another. So, this whole issue of science and scientists and what drives us, for example, I mean, it was my, for me, for personally, it was my curiosity. And just enjoying how, for example, when I got into mathematics and got into differential, integral calculus and that types of things, it was like, wow, I mean, I can describe all kinds of shapes and sizes and understand why there is a focal point, for example, with talking about Newton, reflective mirrors and what the shape of the mirror has to be in order to have a focal point at one point. The beauty of mathematics, for example, enabling us to describe the physical world around us, I think also attracted me, and it obviously attracted Newton into the work that he was doing. Now, there is another interesting aspect. I mean, they talk about a well-rounded guy, even though he had Asperger's syndrome, apparently, that he worked for the Royal Mint for a time. And in his later years, for example, he worked as the a master at the Royal Mint. And so his contributions are not only to science, but it's to practical things like, okay, money. And how do we make our money more counterfeit proof? And that's exactly what he did at the Royal Mint. And for his work at the Royal Mint, for example, he was given his scientific achievement, earned him knighthood by Queen Anne in 1705. So, you can be curious about all kinds of stuff. You can contribute in all kinds of areas. And I think a well-rounded scientist, for example, does contribute in various areas just because of his interest in the world around him.
Is science the same today? It seems to me, if you go back to Galileo and Descartes and Wallace and Kepler and Newton and the others, that these were really basic things. Like, these were initial developments in science that resulted in, you know, the Age of Enlightenment and the Age of Technology and so forth that we're well advanced in now. Are there still scientists at that level who are pioneering new ground in science? I mean, is there new ground in science to pioneer?
Oh, there's all kinds of ground to pioneer. Unfortunately, it's in the realm of you can't see it. And so a lot of it. I mean, you know, for example, quantum mechanics is such a strange field, and you get all kinds of strange phenomena when you get down to the particles that make up the physical atoms, for example, and the neutrons and the protons and the electrons. Those are all made up of subatomic particles, and to try to describe them, it's like, okay, it's here today, gone tomorrow. Where did it go? Why did it go? I mean, you know, it gets really strange. And apparently a particle or here in this physical, locality affects some particle that could be billions of light years away. And how do you explain that? Unless, of course, the universe kind of wraps around and there's multiple dimensions to the universe. So that is part of the challenging work that's going on now. And all of the colliders, for example, that are smashing protons together and other charged particles together to find out, okay, when you smash these things together and they break up into parts, let's analyze what particles they make and see where we go from there. And it's a strange world once you get into that level. And the interesting thing that I find, of course, looking at it from a spiritual point of view, of course, is that when you start breaking up particles, they no longer have particle characteristics, but wave characteristics, and that is particle. That is part. That was discovered back in the 40s and in the 30s. Light, for example, was both had both particle and wave characteristics. But the more you break things up, the more wave-like it becomes, and it's almost like God spoke, and because he spoke, and he disturbed the space, that everything that is made that we see is really nothing more than vibrations in space. And so, the more we learn, the more we find out that, well, maybe the Bible can be used and describe our physical universe, and while we often think of God speaking as just a kind of an allegory, okay, he spoke and then things happened, could it be more practical or more of a literal description of what he actually did, and that describes the world around us.
So there's an interesting aspect of his history. It's talking about his time at Cambridge University and his writings and his mathematical theories. The article mentions that he received initial opposition, and I'm wondering if that opposition, as it is today, is often political and not scientific. You think politics messed with science back in Newton's day like it does today?
Oh, just look at Galileo Galilei. I mean, he had tremendous opposition, especially, when he said, hey, look, folks, wait a minute. Let's look at this. It looks like, the sun, that the planets revolve around the sun and not everything else revolving around the earth. And so he got into big trouble by saying that the earth was not the center of the universe, or suggesting that the earth was not.
Of course, that opposition came from the church, though, not from other scientists necessarily.
Well, the church and the state were closely related, and so, yes, it came from the church, and he was, persecuted for it. Newton, it sounds like he was the type of guy that probably had a little perfectionism in him, and he was proud of the work he did. And then when he got pushback from the scientific community, because, all great breakthroughs are against the grain. The science thinks they have it all figured out. And the scientist of the time, for example, and he came up with ideas that were different than the norm. And that is what makes great science, is in spite of the opposition, you come up with an answer that seems to be more correct or easier to explain the phenomenon that you're trying to describe. And this is exactly what happened with Newton initially. And so because of the opposition, and that was with reflection, is optics initially, but which then ultimately got him into the Royal Society, it was he didn't publish, for example, his great work, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. He didn't publish that for a number of years because of the possible opposition to it that he would have received. So it sounds like he was a sensitive guy and, didn't took opposition, to heart, and kind of maybe hindered him or slowed him down, maybe in some areas, at least in making things known to the public. But of course, he was working behind the scenes, and we're putting all these theories together in spite of the potential opposition that he received.
And he came from an underprivileged background, a poor family, lost his father at an early age, his mother remarried and had to take him out of school for financial reasons. And they mentioned and made some of the other scientists that he drew strength from had similar challenging beginnings to life. I'm wondering if somehow that blends into a scientific a penchant for science. If adversity, it creates comedians and artists, is also partially responsible for generating science, or is that pure intellect? I don't know. What conditions you to go into science? And there's something connected here. David and I were talking yesterday about the Russian military and the leadership and the failures of their campaign in Ukraine. And on the surface, it seems like their leadership is leading people who are not prepared to accept it or to exercise it themselves. We were talking about the middle grade of staff, non-commissioned officers and so forth that are really the backbone of our military, who can make decisions and independent judgments. If we go back to the 60s, there was a great competition between Russia, or then the Soviet Union, and America to develop scientists and engineers. And in this country, anybody could become one. In that country, it seemed if you showed promise, you were forced, you were directed into one of those disciplines. You were into mathematics or physics or chemistry or whatever it was. How much does freedom of thought encourage scientists as opposed to a totalitarian form of government? Because we've already talked about government and science and the relationship between the two. Is there a standard that needs to be met to get good science?
Well, I think to get good anything, you need to have freedom of expression, freedom of thought. Otherwise, you get mediocrity, and the human spirit does not like to be forced. I mean, I don't know if you remember that when you were a little kid, that you didn't necessarily want to be forced to clean your room. Okay, there could be rewards. You can get a cookie after you clean your room. But the human spirit just doesn't, respond well to to being forced. And so, good science, good anything, comes out of the freedom to be able to think and to work on problems without being pressured to come up with a solution, let's say. I think that that is the foundation of having good science. Now, when you start pressuring people or trying to force them to say, okay, you got to make this rocket fly, I can only imagine what the there was an interest, obviously, in the scientists in Germany to make the V2 rocket, but at the same time Hitler was obviously pressuring them to get this accomplished, and I could imagine that the same thing was happening in Russia. And you have to buy into the system first to be able to say, okay, I'm going to put my whole effort into this. Because science is not one of those things, it's not a 9-to-5 job, really. Because, once you're in pursuit of trying to figure something out, you're going to work on it until you get it figured out.
You are driven by a passion.
You're driven by a passion. Good science requires a passion to find the answer, and that's probably the one of the fundamentals of life. Good anything, requires a passion. So, if you're not passionate about it, I would say, okay, that's probably not for you. I mean, so you have to have the passion in order to drive you to come up with answers that somebody else has not come up with.
Well, it's clear that Sir Isaac Newton had the passion and lived a very rich life and endowed us with some major gifts. Quite a story, and we'll leave a link to this article in the chat window of BrokenRoadRadio.com. You can read it if you want. It's basically biography, but it's fascinating. I should mention that CreationMoments.com is a website where you can find scientific information that supports the biblical story of creation. And we often talk about Genesis and the Bible and the beginnings when Don joined us. And who knows where we'll go next week. We've touched on a lot of topics over the last few months here. And this one, Don, you taught us some things about science in general and science in specific with respect to Newton. So we appreciate that. Thank you.
I would guess that being a scientist never stops.
Oh, you're always curious. I mean, the drive to try to figure things out is always there.
That's what
and
I'm thinking.
If there's a challenge, you want to master the challenge. Overcome it.
Well, Don, have a good week. We will join you next Tuesday, or you'll join us, hopefully, be available, and we'll look forward to that. Okay?
Okay, sounds great. Yeah, bye-bye. You folks have a great week.
See you next week, Don.